Can you please come to order? It is 1:34 on the afternoon of Wednesday, April 11th, 2012. This is the Senate Judiciary Committee coming to order. We have quorum to conduct business. Senator Coghill is here, Vice Chair Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. We have four items on the agenda today. We had, and just for folks who are here, we had hoped to amend and move a bill of Senator Wilkowski's dealing with the PSEA. That's going to have to wait until Friday because of a snafu in my office, and so that'll happen on Friday. The first, I'm hoping to hear and move two bills and then hear two new bills. The first two bills we've heard previously are HB 224, sale of nicotine products to minors, HB 55, knives, gravity knives, and switchblades. Let's turn to HB 224 first. That was a bill brought to us by Representative Seaton regarding the sale or gifts of products containing nicotine to a minor under certain conditions. We heard public testimony. I believe we closed public testimony. And with that, I will look to the will of the committee. Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move CS for House Bill number 224 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill's moved, and we'll just keep moving through to the next one, and then we'll take an addies for the paperwork. HB 55 is now before the committee. HB 55 is a bill brought to us by Representative Newman. It deals with gravity knives, switchblades, and amending the definitions thereof into state statute to sort of separate gravity knives from switchblades. And we heard public testimony, took a good statement from the sponsor, and heard from the public. I'll look at the will of the committee. Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move CS for House Bill number 55 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. We will now take a brief at ease for the paperwork. Back on the record. Next up is HB 343, Disclosure of Children's Records. I see Representative Munoz is here. Welcome to the committee. Please come forward, and let's welcome Senator Passman to the committee as well. And Senator Passman, we're just turning to House Bill 343. Welcome, Representative. Please put yourself on the record. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kathy Munoz, representative for District 4, and with me today is Tony Newman with the Division of Juvenile Justice. Thank you for the opportunity to present HB 343. The bill does three primary things. The first area of the bill, Sections 1 and 2, improve the sharing of information between the Division of Juvenile Justice and the Office of Children's Services to help the agencies collaborate to better serve their young clients. Current law allows for this collaboration, the sharing of information, but sometimes the nature of the relationship as two divisions within the same department is not always understood by some staff, attorneys, or judges that work with the divisions. In fact, prior to 1999, the two divisions were one division under the same department, the Department of Health and Social Services. But in part due to federal funding requirements, the two agencies separated into two divisions at that time. The second part of the bill is Section 3, and this allows individuals, former clients, their parents and guardians that were once in state custody, those that have legitimate interest to personal information It allows the Division of Juvenile Justice to share that information with former clients. This is important in applying for certain jobs, the military. It could be that the Division of Juvenile Justice has old records, medical records, that the individual needs access to. So this clarifies that those with legitimate interest, once they are no longer clients of the system, that when they become adults, they do have a legitimate interest and a right to that information. Okay, the third part of the bill is in Section 4. This will streamline the current law on public disclosure of juvenile information. The current law is very cumbersome. It's very difficult to implement. It can take many hours or many days to determine whether or not information is publicly disclosable or not. This will make it easier for the state to release appropriate information in delineated crimes, those listed in the bill, when the minor has been adjudicated a delinquent. House Bill 343 is supported by the Division of Juvenile Justice and the Office of Children's Services. This is a priority bill for the department. And again, I appreciate you hearing it today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Newman, welcome. Oh, I should ask, any questions for the bill sponsor? I don't see any. Well done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tony Newman. I'm a program officer with the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Juvenile Justice. And we're grateful to Representative Munoz for carrying this bill for us and for her staff working with us so well. She provided a good overview of what the bill does. I just thought I'd add a few extra points. Improving child protection and the juvenile justice system's ability to work together, as the bill's first two sections do, is a cause that has been embraced by advocacy organizations for both systems, including the Child Welfare League of America, the National Council for Juvenile and Family Court Judges, and the Center for Juvenile Justice Reform. Here in Alaska, this statute change will demonstrate to Division of Juvenile Justice staff, to Office of Children's Services staff, to the families that we serve, to attorneys, judges, that we are dedicated to improving services and outcomes for kids and families through collaboration. The bill's third section will enable the division to be more responsive to requests we receive for information, particularly from individuals who have a need for some background on their juvenile histories. I receive some of these calls myself, adults who were formerly involved with the juvenile justice system and can't quite remember what it was that they had committed all those years ago or what the outcome of the offense was, whether it was brought to court or not. Or we'll receive a call from a young lady wondering if her physician can receive information that was gathered about her while she was at McLaughlin Youth Center, and that would be helpful for helping her with her medical services now. These calls have become more commonplace lately as barrier crimes and background checks and rights to medical information have become asserted through the federal HIPAA law. This section of the bill will make it easier for us to help these individuals as they look for jobs, seek medical care, and seek other benefits that can help them with their lives now. The final section of the bill will improve the ability of our staff and the public to understand when information about a juvenile offense is subject to public disclosure and when it is not. I can speak to how time-consuming and challenging it is to interpret the current law because I've had to do it myself when a request has come into our office for information about a juvenile. I've spent the better part of a day going through a juvenile's record to make sense of what can be disclosed under that law. The revision proposed in this bill will ensure that the public can continue to access information about offenses that represent the most serious risks to public safety while protecting the confidentiality of juveniles who pose little or no risk. I'd like to close by emphasizing that the bill will not change the laws surrounding victim notification. Victims can still receive information about cases involving juvenile offenders. Law enforcement agencies, schools, foster parents, and others with well-established rights to juvenile information will continue to receive the information they need to do their work effectively. The laws surrounding child abuse and neglect cases are not swept up in the aspects of the bill that allow public disclosure regarding juvenile justice cases. What the bill will do is improve the division's ability to manage, exchange, and disclose juvenile information while respecting the state's desire for its juvenile justice system to both serve public safety and help kids put offensive delinquent behavior behind them. And with that, I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Newman, thank you. Questions? Senator Passman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleasure to see you again. Yesterday when we met, I did have that question as far as the pragmatic, how does this really work? So the guardian ad litem or the OCS employee you know, how do they trigger this so that it gets to court, so that it's not just paying lip service to a court process? How, you know, so if you could kind of walk me through that, please.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, you're referring to Section 1 of the bill, which states that the Office of Children's Services and the Division of Juvenile Justice, Child Protection Agencies and Juvenile Justice Agencies will be presumed to be able to share information. However, an individual may ask the court to review that exchange of information and make a determination that it's in the child's best interest to not have that exchange of information. The statute is intended to make it clear that there's a presumption that that information sharing occurs. An amendment was added on the on the House floor last week that would provide sort of a safety valve. This was crafted by the department in collaboration with the Public Defender Agency that would allow sort of the safety valve so that that information would not be shared. In the conversation that you and I had, we talked about how does the OCS worker make an objection. The intention of the statute isn't for OCS to object to the sharing with DJJ. The intention is for that information exchange to occur and for us to manage that information as a department. It's the GAL, the child's attorney, who would make the objection. And they would do that through application to the court and the court making a motion that is not in the best interest of the child. Does that help answer the question? We intend to, as far as what information an OCS worker would have, we intend to develop policy and regulation that helps guide our staff in understanding what kind of information we're talking is appropriately exchanged between the divisions.
Senator Pascvan.
Is there a file that they would file that in, or is this a new action, so to speak? In other words, what I'm just trying to get the logistics. You know, I understand that if it's a guardian ad litem and it's a kid under the age of 18, that you would file it then in that GAL action. But, you know, is that always where it would be? In other words, I'm just trying to figure it out.
Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, throughout the vast majority of our state, this information sharing is already underway. The Division of Juvenile Justice employees have access to the Office of Children's Services database. The Office of Children's Services employees have access to our Juvenile Offender Management Information System. So that information, and they often are co-located in the same offices and are able to share information. So that information sharing is already underway virtually without incident throughout most of the state. There are pockets of areas where staff aren't sure that they're able to share that information. This statute will demonstrate for our staff that it's presumed that information sharing is allowed to occur, both through access to one another's databases and through individual interaction between staff members.
Yeah, again, I'm looking to that 0.5% of the information that it's in the child's best interest that it not be disclosed. So then, you know, again, is there, you say you go to the court, but are you filing a new action? Is it in the guardian ad litem procedure that where they appointed the guardian ad litem for the minor? In other words, what's the physical mechanism to get to the courthouse?
Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, it is incumbent upon the individual who objects to that disclosure to make the motion. So it would be the GAL, or it would be the attorney to take that step to file that motion. And if
Stacey Crailey is here, she may be able to answer that question as the attorney who's counsel to the Department of Health and Social Services.
Yeah. Ms. Crailey, Senator Pascvan.
No, in other words, if it's a civil filing, is it a $75 cost? It's all. Are you filing a new action? Is this? In other words, I don't know this area of law at all. I'm just trying to find out how the. And again, I understand that you want to have the vast majority of this information shared. I'm just talking about that 0.5% of the information that shouldn't be shared. Somebody makes the determination. How do you get physically in front of a judge? What processes follow?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Stacey Crailey. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, for the vast majority of these situations, they are already existing court cases. So there would be a child in need of aid action that is pending or a juvenile justice action that is pending. And in that context, the guardian ad litem or the public defender or the child's parent or guardian could make application, file motion in those existing cases. There could be, on occasion, in a rare occasion, I believe, a situation where information, where there is not a pending child need of aid action or a pending juvenile justice matter. In that instance, then there would need to be an application to the court for a you know, an original action, if you will, to file an action to protect or to prohibit further disclosure because the disclosure would not be in the best interest of the minor. And again, that would be made by the individuals. And so as to the filing fee issue, that's an interesting question, and I must admit we didn't think about that in that instance where most of these cases are already arising in an existing civil context, i.e. a child in need of aid case, or a juvenile justice matter that is already open and active in the Superior Court.
Good. Okay. I have a couple questions. Senator Coghill, maybe just, this is for either witness, just describe for us sort of the tension between the desire to protect juveniles from the stupid acts they commit before they turn 18 and the need for the public to have some awareness of those acts or where it can be helpful to have that information come out to the public.
Mr. Chairman, the juvenile justice system's mission is to hold offenders accountable for their behavior, to protect public safety, to help victims be restored, and to help juveniles get the competencies and skills they need to move on and keep from committing delinquent behavior and then criminal behavior as adults. So our mission, we see it as restorative and rehabilitative. And as such, there is a tension between keeping that information about their offenses secure and confidential and also making sure the public has a right to information that they may need to feel that their safety is protected. And I believe that the intention of the 1997 law regarding public disclosure was an attempt to reconcile those sort of that sort of tension, that there was some information that should be available for the public to have regarding juvenile offenders.
Would you say it's still fair to say that to a large degree, the records of a juvenile, of the acts that he or she commits as a juvenile, will stay confidential?
Yes.
That's the general rule.
We have another set of that basic. That there are, the statute is very specific about the conditions under which our agency records may be released. It names specific people generally, law enforcement agencies, foster parents, victims who can receive information. So part of the reason for this bill is to provide a little bit of an opening for those reasons to release information that we believe will be rehabilitative and in the child's interest.
Okay, I have a question about your, just one second, I have a question about your chart. Okay, this is an impressive chart. I don't know who prepared this, but they deserve a medal. And one of the more persuasive aspects of your bill is that it takes that chart and reduces it down to this one, which is a big step forward. But at the risk of me plunging into an area where I'm not always an expert, I've circled part of that chart. Do you see the part I've circled up there on
yes.
the top? Okay. Now, my math, I always have to go back to grade school on that little greater than or equal to sign, but I always think it's the alligator mouth that's trying to eat the bigger thing, right?
Okay.
Right? And so I think we may have it pointing in the wrong direction here, because I think what you mean to say is if the juvenile is less than 13 years at the time of the offense, then it's not disclosed. And if he's greater than, it is disclosed. Right?
I think you may be right. Juvenile is greater. I read that as greater than. If
right.
juvenile is greater than or equal to 13 years of age at the time of the offense, if they are
it
greater than
right.
or 13, then, well, wait a minute. Then, yes, the offense moves toward the disclosable.
But you've got both directions. See, then you got no. I guess you're asking the question, is the juvenile greater than 13 at a time? Yes.
Yes.
Disclosed. No.
Then it's disclosed. No, that means he's under 13.
There we go.
Therefore, so it is pointing in the right direction.
Pointing in the right direction.
This right.
This is so happy about that. Excellent work.
And that's, and Mr. Chairman, and that's
maintaining the current public disclosure law, back in 1997, they made the decision that when a youth is under 13 years of age, there's little reason why that information needs to be disclosed to the public, and we've maintained that in the current version of the bill.
And I had a question just about the drafting on the towards the back of the bill. I just flagged it a second ago. About electronic means, page 5, bottom of the page, lines 29 through 30. I think this is saying if you have the material in electronic form, you can disclose it by electronic form. It just seems like it took a lot of words to get there, but is that what it's saying?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. And let's move up the page on that same page 5. Just kind of walk through the 7 enumerated offenses and describe how it is they fit into the scheme of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, the 7 enumerated offenses are offenses that we brought over from the original law. Under certain conditions under the current law, these 7 serious offenses were deemed to have a special category to be eligible for public disclosure. We maintain those. Basically, what these are saying is when a minor comes to us who's been alleged to have committed one of these offenses, and the juvenile ends up being adjudicated, which is analogous to an adult conviction in the adult system. We say minors are adjudicated delinquent in the juvenile system. Then that's the point at which the information becomes disclosable. And other lesser offenses, such as misdemeanors that are felonies that are misdemeanors against persons, or felony offenses involving property that are not arson or burglary, those are not eligible for public disclosure. So we're limiting public disclosure to these 7 categories of offense, provided the juvenile is over 13 or over, and that the court has adjudicated them delinquent on that offense.
And there's no sort of in some aspects of the juvenile law, we hold a person sort of under your jurisdiction up to age 21. Is that right? For the vast majority of kids, it stops when they turn 18.
Mr. Chairman, juvenile jurisdiction applies up for new offenses applies up to the age of 18. If a juvenile is already under our jurisdiction, we can maintain them under probation supervision or in state's custody until their 19th birthday. And if the juvenile agrees to it and a court agrees to it, a few juveniles may be maintained up until their 20th birthday. That happens occasionally, but
so not 21, but 20. Is 20 is the maximum, you're done with them.
That's correct.
And so do these changes of the laws pertain strictly to people under 18? In any event, might these laws pertain to someone who is 19, or am I off?
Mr. Chairman, if generally when an individual, say, who is already under our jurisdiction, when they're 19 and they commit a new offense, they will be managed in the adult system at that point. And we, my understanding is we sort of surrender our authority over them and let the adult system, since they're now over the age of majority, take it from there.
Your record keeping at that point stops. But in the future, those records can still be disclosed under the terms of the bill.
Public disclosure will be maintained for 5 years after the adjudication occurs.
And why the 5-year cutoff?
Mr. Chairman, the original public disclosure law, as I recall, had a similar 5-year cutoff, and we maintain that in part because it made sense to us. Public disclosure seemed to us to be about ensuring public safety, and after 5 years, after 5 years, no more offenses occurring, it seems like to us that the public safety concern will have passed by then, and there's little reason to argue that there's a public safety need to be able to get this information available to the public if the individual has been, if the offense has occurred over 5 years ago.
Senator Coghill.
I think by then they might go into the adult system if that's what happens, which frequently happens. So I kind of remember some of this discussion. This is for people who, for example, I have somebody in a school, they may want to know that they're dangerous, or in a foster home, they may want to know if there has been some danger, or is that the kind of circumstance that this would work under?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, there are allowances for people in for foster parents, for instance, to receive information. Under different statutes, foster parents can get information about a juvenile's history. Victims can get information about a juvenile.
So this is just general public information?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, yes.
Okay.
Generally, has there been any opposition to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Pretty straightforward. Anyone else, anyone online who wants to testify about HB 343? Anyone in the room who wants to testify? That I'll close public testimony and have invited testimony only. I know I see Mr. Steiner is on the line from the Public Defender Agency. Mr. Steiner, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. And I'm making myself available to answer any questions.
Well, generally, does the Public Defender Agency have any concerns about the bill as it comes to this committee?
Throughout the process of this bill, I've worked fairly closely with Mr. Newman on addressing the concerns of the agency. Section 4 of the bill is, I think, an unambiguous improvement to the current statutory scheme, and that was some of the work that we did. We also worked on Section 1 of the bill that addressed the agency's most significant concern, which is the information sharing between OCS and the Division of Juvenile Justice. The section there that was changed to address some of our concerns was that opportunity to oppose disclosure, because there are certain circumstances under which the sharing of information is arguably not in the child's best interest. And preserving that opportunity to object was critical. That's presently how things have been working. There's been litigation on this issue of information sharing, and some courts have found that it's in the best interest not to. And so that was critical for us.
And just to follow up for me, the juvenile, would that individual be entitled to a opportunity to oppose the release of these records?
Mr. Chairman, generally, yes. It's an option. The opportunity is really where more of a strategic question, because it will often probably have to come from the GAL and the child in need of aid matter. Because at that point, theoretically, there's no juvenile justice case. They could sort of preemptively file a motion for a protective order under that subsection to say this information should never be disclosed, or at least without notice. The other option would be in the juvenile justice case for the juvenile to file something opposing disclosure, although timing could be an issue because the information could be shared right at the onset before the case is screened in. So it really, as a practical matter, falls on the GAL and the China matter to sort of lead this question. But that section leaves open that possibility that they can do that, which I think is significant.
And I think this is my last question. I'm having trouble getting the question as clear as I can. How many of these juveniles whose records are being released will be represented by someone who would have notice of this release? Does the juvenile get notice of the release, or does it just happen by operation of law?
Mr. Chairman, the juvenile wouldn't get notice under this section of the statute. The juvenile in a juvenile justice case may not have a lawyer. There may be an allegation, and the Division of Juvenile Justice may take the allegation and then review the OCS records to make determinations about screening in a case or potential detention decisions. That juvenile might have a lawyer if there's an ongoing and presently ongoing child in need of aid case, or so that's possible, but there is no notice provision.
And yet this is, I guess, a standard enough practice such that in your judgment, it's not necessary.
Well, it's my judgment that this sort of sets the litigation exactly where it is now, which is that the sharing occurs, there's no notice, and there is an opportunity to litigate it. And what we worked closely on was to preserve that option to litigate, because the original versions of the statute did not have that option. So it kind of preserves, in a way, it preserves the status quo.
As I recall, you guys never support bills. Is this another case where you guys don't support a bill?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
I don't mean to phrase it so negatively, but my recollection is you the Public Defender Agency rarely comes out and says we support a bill. But is it fair to say you don't? Is it fair to say you don't oppose it?
I don't take a position either way, Mr. Chairman. But I will say there are sections of the bill, particularly Section 4, that is, I think, an improvement over the statutory scheme.
That's probably as good as it gets, then. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Stein. I don't see any other questions. With that, we will hold the bill over for one hearing. We have lost a quorum. That's the nature of the beast, but I anticipate being able to take action on it soon. So thank you so much for all being here. We'll set the bill aside. Let's turn now to House Bill 168. House Bill 168 is next on the calendar. There's Representative Feige. We do not have a quorum. That doesn't thank you, Representative Munoz. That doesn't stop us from having a hearing. And this time of year, you just can't stop every time you're a little short-handed, or else nothing happens. Representative Feige, welcome to the committee.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member of the committee.
Well done.
Member singular committee.
Under current law, plaintiffs have little incentives not to file lawsuits and seek injunctions to stop development projects, projects that have already gone through a rigorous permitting process. These legally permitted projects now have to endure the high costs of uncertainty and delay. Discovery phase in these types of cases can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to the state as well as the project proponents. Ultimately, those who feel the most immediate impacts are the workers and their families because workers are laid off, both union and non-union. In 2004, work stoppage was imposed on the Pogo mine. At least 45 union employees were out of work for a period of approximately 2 weeks with no recourse. Alaska Civil Rule 65C, as written, states no restraining order or preliminary injunction shall issue except upon the giving of security by the applicant in such sum as the court deems proper for the payment of such costs and damages as may be incurred or suffered by any party who is found to have been wrongfully enjoined or restrained. House Bill 168 was written to work with 65C. It requires that courts consider the effect of that injunction or stay could have on the employees and contractors of the permittee. It is not intended to change the authority of the court or alter the discretion they already have. Instead, this bill adds another category that should be considered during their deliberation. House Bill 168 does not set a bond amount. Shall give security an amount the court considers proper is the terms used in the bill. It does not prevent Alaskans from challenging government-issued permits. The state of Alaska permitting process allows for ample public comment prior to the granting of the permits, along with many opportunities to appeal. HB 168 does not condone sloppily or wrongfully issued permits, as has been described by some opponents of the bill. If a permittee is violating the terms of the permit, then the issuing departments of the state should step in and either get the situation rectified or temporarily stop the project until it comes into compliance. House Bill 168 does not require the state or municipalities to post a bond. It also does not ask that the bond include compensation for lost profits. Again, arguments raised by opponents of the bill. I've been told that the state courts do not see a large number of these cases, since most appeals are on federal permits and not those issued by the state. Unfortunately, House Bill 168 does not affect those federal cases. As a worker put out of work by one of those lawsuits 3 years ago, I wish I could. In conclusion, I see House Bill 168 as a jobs protection bill. It is an attempt to level the playing field by assuring that the court consider the potential impacts to not only the project proponent, but to the employees and contractors facing a loss of employment when a project is wrongfully enjoined. Questions.
Thank you, Representative Feige. You and I met yesterday afternoon. We spoke about this bill. I asked you about some potential impacts with respect to primacy And after our conversation, I called Ledge Legal and asked them to prepare a memo on that. I know it was shared with you just as the hearing began. That's about the time we got it today. And I just want to, you've got it and read it?
We were familiar with the Utah case, yes.
Okay. And the issue for the public that's listening in is whether or not our law is the same as federal law with respect to injunctions, and too great a separation puts us in jeopardy of losing our primacy on several federal permitting areas that we've assumed primacy on. That's my concern, and it's a concern, to paraphrase this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paged paragraph letter from Les Legal. I asked whether the concerns expressed in the EPA letter to Governor Huntsman back in 2006 could also apply to this bill. The short answer is yes. It's got a different structure. It was an attempt to accomplish the same purpose, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and so I'm just interested in whether you have you had any other legal analysis done on this besides this analysis?
That's my question. Your analysis, or
right. Has your office sought any legal advice with respect to the primacy issue?
We've asked several questions for verification. Yes.
And the response to those questions, are they in memo form, or were they just conversations you had with attorneys?
They were both.
Okay. Did you get any memo back from them that you care to share with us?
I don't have it with me. No, I didn't. So I'm not going to talk specifically about that. But we do not believe that there is a significant primacy, and we've talked to the departments. We would be prepared to offer up some intent language to add to the bill that departments believe would certainly make very clear that it is not our intent to affect the primacy issue.
And we had a bill earlier this year, and I asked the same question about that bill as I'll ask you. Has there been a case in Alaska that sort of points to the need for this bill? That is, has there been an unjust result in a case in Alaska that tells you and tells us we need to pass this bill to prevent that unjust result from happening again?
Senator, in state court, you, of course, have the example of the Pogo mine in May of 2004, where folks were put out of work for a period of about 2 weeks. And there's folks here that will be testifying to that effect. Certainly the concept of coming up with an injunction to stop a resource project is not unusual. Take the case of Shell. Shell's projects on the Chukchi Sea and Beaufort Sea were stopped for several years. That involves almost 700 jobs, the particular summer I was involved. So this is not an unusual event. I think the bill is being somewhat proactive on our part to make sure that our workers and our folks are not put in that position of committing to a project and having the project yanked out from under them because of an injunction.
And in the Shell cases, were there bonds posted in those cases?
I'm not aware. That was in a federal court under federal laws.
But again, we need to keep ours as closely tracking with that law. I mean, the whole primacy issue is over whether or not we track with federal law.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Passman.
I guess just focusing on that, what is the federal legal standard for the posting of bond that would be as the same as or different than what you're proposing?
Senator, I'm not a lawyer. I've got some lawyers that are going to be willing to testify. I'd ask you to ask them that question.
We do have many people signed up to testify. And which of those would you direct us as being... Which of those individuals should be the attorney? Is the attorney witness? Because I can't tell from reading the list.
Oh, I believe the fellow from the RDC can address it.
Okay. Mike Jungris.
Jungris? I believe so, yes.
Okay. We have. We do have further questions for the bill sponsor.
Okay.
Thanks for being here. We do have many people to testify. We may have more questions for you in the future, but we shouldn't get to the public, who has exhibited a fair amount of interest in this bill. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. We have 13 people signed up to testify in about 45 minutes. So why don't we turn to public testimony? And I'll tell folks, you can testify for about 2 minutes or three if it's really compelling. So we'll just kind of start with there. And maybe we'll turn to, and I'm sorry, I hope I'm not saying your name wrong, Mike Jungris?
It's Young Rice, Mr. Chairman.
Young Rice, I'm very sorry, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here on behalf of the Resource Development Council and ask to give a disclaimer that my views are those of myself and the council and not those of Davis Wright Tremaine, my law firm. Let me first say that I think that, as you know, Mr. Chairman, and other members of the committee know, the power to grant injunctions is probably the most awesome and far-reaching power that a judge has. The power to reach out and stop things in their tracks, the power to reach out and make people do things. And this particular proposal is aimed not at a final injunction at the end of the case where the judge has adjudicated who's right and who's wrong, but only at preliminary adjudications that have to be reached where the judge has not yet been able to decide who's right and who's wrong, doesn't know whether a permit, for example, was properly or improperly granted. So this awesome power, which can stop a project, can throw hundreds of people out of work, can shut down small businesses and so forth, is a power that has to be handled with discretion. And what this proposal, what this bill does, is it gives the court some guidelines as to how to evaluate the kind of damage that can be done if an injunction is granted. They can be incredibly damaging. And, again, they're given when the judge doesn't know who's right and who's wrong, does not know who is finally going to win. And right now, they have to function without any real guidelines. The current rules provide no specifics for the judge to consider when they're determining how to set a bond. As a result, you have discretionary calls by the judge that can be all over the map, and it is frequently done no bond is called for. It's frequently done that high bonds are called for. It makes sense for the legislature to weigh in on this topic and give some structure and guidance to the court so they can understand exactly what factors they need to consider when, you know, they exercise what, again, is an awesome and far-reaching power that they must exercise without having decided who's right and who's wrong. I think it's important to emphasize also that the decision that is made does not restrict anybody's access to the court, and indeed does not restrict the ability of the court to make final injunctions at the end of the case when they have decided, for example, that a permit was improperly granted. The judge does not require any bond at all when a final adjudication is made and a permanent injunction is entered. This is only for interim relief, yet this interim relief, which may only last for some period of time, can have devastating impacts on projects and ongoing employment. With respect to the questions that were raised just a couple of minutes ago regarding how different this is from federal law, and I'm sorry that I'm not prepared here with case names, but I know that on the one hand, the Ninth Circuit has occasionally been willing to issue injunctions to stop projects without any bond requirement or with only a minimum bond requirement, and I believe we saw that in the Kensington matter. The Supreme Court has held that there must be a determination made regarding the bond and whether it should be required and the amount that it should be required. So it's certainly consistent with federal law, which has been Alaska's longstanding law, that a bond be issued. There's no federal law that suggests that there's some impropriety in formalizing or making rules that sort of explain or help the court in figuring out, well, what exactly are the damages that they ought to assess. This bill doesn't actually extend the powers of the court, and it doesn't restrict any powers of the court. What it does is it gives guidelines that the court can look to in determining exactly how it decides what damage can be inflicted if an injunction is improperly granted. Right now, the situation is very unbalanced. On the one hand, the applicants have no skin in the game. They're not required to come up with any way to protect the project, the employees, the contractors, for the damage that can certainly be done with a preliminary injunction. And this just tries to redress that balance and put things on an even keel. And finally, I'd point out that there's no restrictions on the state here. That is to say, the state having the power to grant or not grant permits itself isn't going to be seeking an injunction to stop any kind of permit from going forward. So it would only apply to third parties. Those are the gist of my remarks, but if you have any questions, I can take a whack at addressing them.
Just one, are you familiar with the Pogo Mine case?
Yes, I am familiar with the Pogo Mine case. That was, I'm not certain whether that was the result of an injunction that was issued or whether that was a result of other factors that occurred when the permit was called into question. So I cannot say that particular case, was one where this statute would come to play. I can say that, for example, as I said, the Kensington case is one which, had it been in state court, would have invoked this statute, and I think it would have been helpful to all concerned if the courts that were considering this had been able to look to specific guidelines and say, all right, well, here's the kind of damage that the legislature says we need to consider. Let's think about that, and then let's make the decision that we think is proper, which is what the statute calls for.
Senator Passman has a question.
Mr. Young-Rice, can the state from time to time consider filing an injunction or some temporary relief, restraint?
I think that the state is excused from posting a bond for injunctions by law, and I don't think that that proposed statute would impact that.
Follow-up?
So if I may, if I'm understanding then that the state would not follow this rule if the state were seeking an injunction or a restraining order?
That's right. The state wouldn't be covered by this. In terms of a requirement to post some kind of preliminary injunctive bond.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Pascoe, through the chair, I think if the state wanted to stop a project, all they would need to do would be to withdraw the permit or suspend the permit until they came into compliance, if that's why they wanted to stop the project from continuing. The power they already have.
That starts with the premise that you are in the application phase as compared to in the operational phase. Mm-hmm. And so if the state were to see a violation and wanted to enjoin the violation, then the question is whether the state has the ability during the operational phase to seek an immediate injunction. And so what I'm, and obviously the determination whether it's right or wrong may be determined later, but again, I'm past the permitting phase in the operational phase. Mm-hmm. That's because there's no distinction here. So I'm just trying to, again, figure this out.
Senator Baskin, through the chair, I believe the department can shut down a project based on the permitting and following the permitting, but certainly can ask that of any of the departments.
Mr. Young-Rice, thank you. Let's turn to further questions on that point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's turn to Rachel Petro.
Good afternoon, Chairman French and members of the committee. Thanks for taking your time to hear House Bill 168 this afternoon. For the record, my name is Rachel Petro, and I serve as the President and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. We represent hundreds of diverse businesses from across Alaska and thousands of working Alaskans. The vast majority of our members are small business owners. Together, our members share a common goal, and that is to make Alaska a viable and competitive place to do business. Again, thanks for hearing House Bill 168 today. We support the current committee substitute for House Bill 168, and it's our hope that this bill will enjoy the same kind of bipartisan support it enjoyed in the House, and that you will pass House Bill 168 out of your committee very soon. Each year, the Alaska Chamber members set its legislative priorities during our fall legislative policy forum. And this year, our members adopted over 27 positions, but we selected three top priority issues. And litigation reform as it relates to resource development in Alaska was selected as one of our top three priorities for this session. So currently, the cost to challenge a legally permitted project in Alaska is virtually nothing. Instead, the risk is borne by defendants. And often, the discovery phase in litigation can cost the state of Alaska and project proponents hundreds of thousands of dollars in attorney fees. Such delays put Alaskans out of work, creating personal hardship and potentially increasing state service costs. House Bill 168 really just seeks to level the legal playing field without infringing on any party's right to bring a legitimate issue to court by requesting the court consider wages and benefits of workers as well as payments to contractors under current court rules. House Bill 168 does not attempt to change the court rules. Again, it simply articulates the request that wages of working Alaskans be considered. So again, we are very hopeful that House Bill 168 will enjoy the bipartisan support it enjoyed in the House. And again, thanks for the opportunity to testify today and for hearing House Bill 168. Thank you.
Ms. Petro, thank you. And just a quick question. You're in touch with resource development organizations all around the state. And I'll ask the same question of you that I asked of the representative carrying the bill. Do you have any examples of wrongful injunctions that have stopped projects that this bill would have helped slow down that process? Had the person bringing the case for the injunction had to post a bond?
Sorry, you're asking me, Senator. Are you asking me if it would have slowed down bringing the issue to court?
I'm just asking. I guess I'm trying to look for a place where a court went out on a limb, issued an injunction. It was a bad injunction; shouldn't have been issued. Big mistake, and shut down a project that this bill might have prevented the court from doing that because the party seeking the injunction would have had to post a bond.
I'm not prepared to answer specific. I've certainly heard from members all over the state that they are very concerned about this, and I don't think they're unfounded, but I'm happy to get back to you directly with that information.
If you could send us a note or an email or whatever's most appropriate, but the question I keep asking is are we doing something wrong we need to fix? Thank you. Let's turn to two other folks in the Andrew Keller is in Fairbanks, wants to testify. Mr. Keller, are you there?
Hello?
Hi.
Yeah, my name's Andrew Keller, and one point I want to make is that the court already has the means to address frivolous lawsuits, so, that's not addressed by this bill. But with HB 168, individuals, non-governmental organizations, and government entities will be discouraged from questioning enforcement of permits granted to corporations for industrial projects. The posting of a bond that could involve millions of dollars would effectively prohibit whistleblowing. This bill would reduce or eliminate Alaskans' ability to protect our air, water, wildlife, and safety from corporate irresponsibility, government agency error. And I just note we marked the 23-year anniversary of the Exxon Valdez spill, and we must remain vigilant so that activities like that, occurrences like that don't occur again. And I think this bill would make it harder to correct that kind of error that caused the disaster. So thank you for the opportunity testify.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. That was nice, concise testimony. Let's turn to Bob Dixon in Anchorage. Mr. Dixon, are you there?
This is Bob Dixon. I am an attorney, private practice. I've been practicing as of later this year, 40 years in basically commercial litigation, and a good chunk of it, if not maybe a majority of it, in construction litigation. And I would like to speak in favor of the bill. And the first point is that there has been some concern that this prevents or deters access to the courts. It does not. Anyone can still file a lawsuit if they have $150 or can get a waiver of even having to file that. This only comes into account, becomes relevant after the party is in court. So it doesn't deter access to the court and access to whatever the discretion of the judge and the judicial system will have to bear. Further, all it really does is require the courts to follow what Rule 65C already requires. As the sponsor did say, the existing procedural rule says no restraining order or preliminary injunction shall be except upon the giving of hearing, etc. In all my experience and injunctions that I've either tried to get or defended against, I've never seen a bond yet required. And in one of these instances, bonds are not required. So that what this does is it basically requires the court to follow their own rule. Speaking to the primacy question that was raised a little while ago, first of all, that primacy really has to do with the similarity or the acceptability to the federal agencies of the permitting process. What we're talking about is what happens after the permit has been issued. So the primacy issue is not a good argument. It's without merit because the primacy issue deals with the process for issuing permits, and this does not involve that process at all. Further, our procedural rule, Rule 65C, is the same as federal Rule 65C, which says the court may issue a preliminary injunction or temporary restraining order only if the movement gives security in the amount that the court considers proper, et cetera, et cetera. As I say, the problem has been and is today with courts granting these injunctions without requiring a bond, even though the rule requires it. And I know the legal services memorandum that has accompanied this has talked about the legal grounds for getting a preliminary injunction. It is still the rule that AJ Industries versus Alaska Public Service Commission is the standard, but that standard does allow parties to be does allow courts to issue injunctions even when the plaintiff or the defendant, in this case the industrial operation, cannot be adequately protected. There are two basic ways you can get a preliminary injunction. One is where the harm that is alleged to occur is repairable, can be repaired, and where the other party, meaning the defendant of the permittee, cannot be adequately protected, i.e. a bond would be insufficient. At that time, you can still get an injunction if the moving party convinces the court that the moving party has probable success on the merits. And that actually requires very little in a lot of these challenges to development projects. And that's the problem that this act would remedy by just simply requiring the court to require a bond that is going to happen, the damages that will happen, one way or the other, and if it turns out that no injunction was appropriate, that there's money there that can go to the basically the wage people who have been making wages and the subcontractors. As the sponsor said, what this really does is help not the permittee holder who's doing the development, but the actual people who would be working on the project and also the many subcontractors that are normally involved in those kind of projects. The issue, the point that the other point I wanted to make was that this question about tell us where this has actually been a problem, where there's been a wrongful injunction and there were damages and that kind of thing. The reason no one can, other than the Pogo Mine case, the reason that no one can come up with a specific case is because those cases are typically settled and both parties reach a settlement and there's no ultimate determination of a prevailing party or a loser or a winner. And so that's why there are injunctions have been entered, but usually, not always, but usually they get resolved and all parties go their separate ways without with just taking their lumps. And then this would this bill would try to alleviate or remedy that situation. Thank you.
Mr. Dixon, thank you. We have a question from Senator Paskin.
Thank you, Mr. Dixon. Is it a fair statement that in order to maintain compliance with primacy, that the standard can be no less than the same opportunity for judicial review under the federal law?
My understanding is that it has to do with the permitting process, and to the extent that the equivalent in judicial law is there, as I just said, Rule 40, our existing Rule 65C is the same as the federal Rule 65C.
I guess my question is more focused than that, is that in order to maintain the federal primacy, the access to judicial review has to be no less than the same standard for the federal system.
Well, and that access really goes to the ability to appeal to a court, the judicial system, from the issuance of a permit. And this act does not affect that in any way. As I said at the outset, anyone can go into court and try to explain to the judge how the permitting process has been in error or flawed in some way. So the access to the courts is not affected and would be the same in the state court system as it would be in the federal.
Senator Passman has one last question, I think.
Yes, very quickly. Assuming the access is the same, but is there more restrictive application of or penalties imposed under a proposed state system as compared to the existing federal system?
Well,
that one could argue would then be...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
In other words, that then one could argue that the state system is more restrictive than the federal system with respect to the parties before the court.
In my opinion, the access to the courts and the access to judicial help is the same, but if I think what you're really asking, does the federal law have an equivalent of HB 168? And my understanding is it does not. In fact, we know from so many of the injunctions that have been held up in the federal regime that they don't require bonds, even though the federal rule is, as I just read it, you're not supposed to issue any preliminary injunction without granting security. But the courts use this test for a preliminary injunction that I read out of the state Supreme Court opinions. That's basically the same as the federal courts. In fact, our court originally took it from the federal regime, and so the test for getting a preliminary injunction in the federal courts is basically the same. And as I said, you have a lot of federal courts entering these injunctions without requiring any bonds.
Mr. Dixon, this was helpful testimony. Thank you. Let's turn now to the room where we have still about 10 people signed up to testify. Maybe the bill sponsor can make room for someone to come up. Thank you. Terry Sevi?
Sevi.
Mr. Sevi, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and come on up when there's space there for you. Mr. Feige, maybe you could just kind of take a seat back.
Okay.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sevi.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm an Alaskan for now nearly 30 years, a commercial fisherman since 1985, a parent of two children, two school children, and I firmly oppose House Bill 168. fish in Bristol Bay. I've been there for most of that 30 years, among many other places in the state. It is my opinion that House Bill 168 would favor large corporations and strip individuals and smaller groups of their right to take action against such corporations by making it economically impossible for them to do so. Such a bill would create an insurmountable financial barrier between Alaskans and big, often outside and foreign interest, thus infringing upon Alaskans' constitutional rights to access the courts and threaten Alaskans' control over federal water, land, and air and permitting. Such a bill would prevent Alaskans from bringing forth legitimate cases for judicial review while protecting untidy permits and resource extraction. Alaskans must see to it that our resources are developed prudently to ensure future generations will inherit clean air and clean water. Such a bill lacks such wisdom and creates certain potential for both ecological and economical disaster. Thank you.
Mr. Sebi, thank you for coming forward. I don't see any questions.
Thank you.
Bonnie Zirkel. Ms. Zirkel, welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe pull that mic over closer to you.
I can move over here.
Or vice versa. Thanks.
My name is Bonnie Zirkel. I came from Palmer. My husband and I have lived in Palmer for the last 25 years. I've had a business in tourism for the last 20. I've been a hunting guide for 25 years. My husband has been a residential contractor for 20 years. I would like to just say that I'm very much against the House Bill 168, and I have some photos here that I'm hoping that you will take the time to take a look at.
If you give them to my committee aide, we'll take a look.
Sure will. I brought some showing the damage to our family home in West Virginia. The West Virginia home is in a mile of an open pit mine that used to blast once a day. The proposed Wishbone Hill mine in Palmer would have the same blasting schedule. Our home and hundreds of other homes are within a 1 mile distance the same. I have photos showing devastating impacts from heavy rains that mining and the rains have in West Virginia. When the slurry ponds burst in West Virginia, there was a 3-foot high wall of toxic waste that came down the hill across the family farm and into a once crystal clear native brook trout stream. Killed all forms of life, destroying water wells and property. While the Wishbone Hill area has a history of underground mining, it also has a long history of flooding and heavy rains. These rains shut down the mining many years ago. Just 5 to 6 years ago, heavy rains took out the Moose Creek Bridge and half of our blacktop road. I have photos showing the trout stream 25 years ago after the slurry breach. And then in December, when I returned there, I took pictures today, 25 years later, and it's still dead. The slurry pond disaster in West Virginia is not located on a fault line, like the proposed Wishbone Hill mine. We have lost 4 family members to coal-related illnesses. The risk of resource development can be high. If this bill passes, how will we be able to protect our homes in the Mat-Su Valley if something similar happens? How will we protect our families if the permitting process doesn't work? The good, hard-working people of the Valley should not be looked at as a cost of doing business. House Bill 168 takes away our rights to protect our property, our livelihoods, and our families. It is because of what has already happened to our family that I will continue to fight for our rights to have a voice. It is fundamental to our democracy that citizens be able to take complaints to court. The bill would make that even harder for Alaskans. That is why I'm opposed to this legislation. Thank you.
Ms. Zirkle, thank you. Thank you for coming down to Juneau and testifying in person. Next up is Andy Motoro. Andy Motoro, Mr. Motoro, come forward. Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record. Happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Chair French and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Motoro, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Conservation Alliance. Committee members should have received a letter from our organization. I'm not going to reiterate it here. We are concerned that this legislation is unconstitutional, punitive, and does absolutely nothing to stop frivolous litigants in the state. You know the summary of the bill? It would require Alaskans to bond for the corporate costs of delay if, after an initial review, a judge issues temporary relief. Temporary relief, placing a hold on the permit, is given after a judicial review of a case. And it's only granted if two things are decided. One, that a case is strong and likely to succeed. And two, that irreparable harm will occur if temporary relief is not granted. This only happens after judicial review. If a case is frivolous, a judge will push it out. And in that way, the bill is somewhat backwards. I also think that this just general practice punishes only the Alaskans that bring the strongest cases to court. And it does nothing to punish the frivolous litigant. Requiring a citizen to pay for a governmental error or a corporation not following the terms of its permits runs very contrary to the long American tradition of protecting whistleblowers, and that's truly what the litigants are in these cases. I think our communities, tribal organizations, municipalities, and individual Alaskans should have the right to stand up for clean air, land, and water. And with that, I'm done and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions for Mr. Motoro? I don't see any. Thanks for being here. Next up is Tom Waldo. Mr. Waldo. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Waldo. I'm an attorney with Earth Justice here in Juneau. I've been here a little over 22 years. I was hired in 1989 to work on the Exxon Valdez oil spill litigation, and I've been here ever since. Earth Justice is a nonprofit public interest law firm. We represent conservation groups, Indian tribes, tourism businesses, municipal governments, and others in their efforts to protect clean water, clean air, fish, wildlife, and other resources that are important to Alaskans. We're opposed to HB 168 because it impermissibly prevents citizens from making effective use of the courts to protect these resources by requiring them to post unaffordable bonds. I want to emphasize that it's really hard to get a preliminary injunction. You have to show two things. You have to show that you're likely to succeed on the merits of your claim, and you have to show that you'll suffer irreparable harm in the absence of the injunction or the stay. In other words, you can only get an injunction or a preliminary injunction or a stay if you have a really strong case and if you really need it. In most cases, we don't ask for preliminary injunctions or stays, but when we do, they're really important. In my experience, bonds for injunctions for industrial operations would frequently run in the millions of dollars, which is simply out of reach for citizens who bring these kinds of cases. In effect, it's a bill that prevents people from getting preliminary injunctions or stays in any circumstances, which in many cases prevents getting relief that's actually needed to avoid irreparable harm in the case. We think it's unconstitutional for three reasons. First, it changes court rules adopted by the Alaska Supreme Court that already govern injunctions, stays, and bonds. This bill would require bonds where those rules currently allow the court discretion. Second, it violates equal protection because it unfairly singles out a particular class of citizens, those who challenge industrial permits, for particularly discriminatory treatment. And third, it violates due process because it deprives citizens of meaningful access to the courts to get needed interim relief where you need that kind of preliminary injunctive relief or stays. I want to address one thing that's come up in the testimony of several of the witnesses so far, which is the Pogo mine. Our office represented the appellants in that litigation, so I'm personally familiar with it. That litigation was not in state court. In fact, it wasn't even in federal court. It was an EPA appeal. It was a federal agency. EPA issued a permit under the Clean Water Act, and we appealed it to the Environmental Appeals Board, which is a body within EPA. So it was simply part of the administrative process. It never went to court. Moreover, we did not seek an injunction or a stay in that case. We simply filed an appeal to establish a legal point about the jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. In response to that appeal, the Pogo mine laid off its workers and ceased construction. And people attribute that to an injunction, but there never was an injunction. The parties to that case did not intend to shut down the mine. It wasn't the purpose of the appeal. They didn't ask the agency to do that. It never went to court. So it's a particularly inappropriate example to illustrate any reason for HB 168. And in fact, in all of the deliberations over this bill that we've heard so far, I've yet to hear a single example of an inappropriate injunction that would be prevented or where the party would have been protected by this legislation. In effect, what this bill would do is it would prevent citizens from getting desperately needed relief in those cases where it's appropriate in order to avoid a hypothetical problem that no one has been able to establish even really exists in the real world. For these reasons, we oppose HB 168. Thank you for considering my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Questions for Mr. Waldo? I don't see any. Thanks for being here. Next up is Emily Breese. Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Glad you like my chair.
It's very comfy. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak. My name is Emily Breese, and I'm from Healy, where I attend high school at Tri-Valley School. I have been very involved with my student and local government in a number of ways. I appreciate my constitutional right that is perhaps the greatest privilege I experience as an American citizen, the right to have my voice heard and access the courts. We must use the rights granted to us by the drafters of the Constitution of the United States of America to peaceably put forth our concerns. I'm here to testify against HB 168. House Bill 168 works to erode this vital right. The option to bring forth our local grievances and issues for our people and governments to see is a certain and unalienable right. The ability to ask questions, to voice concerns or support, to speak to you today, these are all actions we treasure. I live in a town which coexists and feels the effects of resource development. It is not fair that I feel my house shake each day from the mine blast, and I am informed of the potential of fracking literally occurring right beneath my house. And I will not be able to ask for a second look on these projects because I cannot afford to. This is un-American. With checks and balances in place, it is the job for the court systems to weed out frivolous lawsuits. If a court finds reason for an injunction, then we should listen. I do not support this bill because it goes against the American principle that no matter who I am or how much money I have, I can still raise my voice and have a say in the operations of government and industry that directly affect my life. Opposing this bill does not mean I oppose jobs. If anything, by opposing this bill, I'm supporting the creation of future jobs. I'm supporting the responsible cultivation of natural resources. I'm supporting the health and safety of my family and community members. By opposing House Bill 168, I'm supporting the right to have an equal opportunity to have my voice heard. Thank you.
Ms. Breese, thank you. You're a high school student?
Yes.
Very remarkable. Thank you. Thanks for coming down. Next up is Mike Satry. Satry. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Satry. Put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair French, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Satry. I was born and raised here in Southeast Alaska. Juneau is my home, and I'm currently employed as the executive director of the Council of Alaska Producers. Council is a nonprofit trade association representing large metal mines and major metal development projects here in the state of Alaska. We appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of this bill. We appreciate the fact that you're hearing it here today. The Council supports a rigorous science-based permitting system that allows for efficient and responsible development of Alaska's resources. We encourage and respect the public's involvement and input through the currently established public process used to manage these resources. Once this public process has been completed and permits are issued, opponents of a project can file litigation asking for an injunction or stay of these permits in order to delay and potentially stop this permitted development. If this litigation is ultimately found to have no merit, it is Alaskan workers and their families who suffer the most due to lost wages and opportunity. To mitigate this issue, this bill requires parties seeking an injunction or stay of a permit to post a bond to cover, amongst other things, lost wages and benefits if it is found the suit has been wrongfully enjoined. The language in this bill, as we've heard, closely follows the existing language in Court Rule 65C, which already requires the posting of a bond. In both cases, the courts have broad leeway in fixing the amount of this bond. However, in the course of HB 168, the court is directed to consider the potential for lost wages and benefits when addressing industrial operations. By supporting this bill today, we are here to ask you for assistance in protecting the rights and the workers of an industrial operation that has legally been issued a state permit. But in doing so, we need to be very cognizant and respectful of an individual's rights to seek relief through the courts if they believe a permit has been granted in error. By giving the courts broad discretion in the calculation of the bond, we do believe that this bill protects the rights of both parties. In summary, I just want to state what the Council believes HB 168 does not and does do. This bill does not affect federal permits, appeals, or litigation, as we've heard. It does not prevent appeals or litigation of state permits, and we do not believe it impairs the state's regulatory responsibilities or permit enforcement activities. What we think it does is encourage involvement in the early stages of public participation in the permitting process. It requires litigants of state permits to recognize the financial risk of their actions to other Alaskans, and we hope that it will provide security for Alaskan workers and their families. Thank you for your time, and I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Satcher, I don't see any, but thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Next up is Kathy Wasserman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kathy Wasserman, the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. And just to clarify, I'm not a high school student. I was just
about to ask.
Yes, I know. I figured you would. That's why I clarified that. First of all, AML is very concerned about this bill. I believe you just got some recent information that said municipalities were exempt. We had not heard that before, and some of the people that we had looking at this bill were unclear on that issue as well. Under court rule, at the present time, municipalities are exempt from securities in injunctions, and we're very concerned that that should stay that way. Municipalities, hopefully, represent the people within their jurisdiction, and they need to be able to have the ability to do what they must to represent the people in their community. So we would like to make sure that they are still exempt under court rule.
Thank you. Yeah, I heard the gentleman, Mr. Jungreis, say that he thought the state might be exempt from the rule, but I certainly didn't hear him say that the municipalities would from the statute.
Right. And Mr. Chairman, while there is, I guess, in this latest paperwork, that sentence, we would have to make totally sure that indeed is true. That's a big issue to give up if that is indeed not true.
Thank you, Ms. Wasserman. I don't see any questions.
I'm still confused as to whether she's a high school student.
I know.
Attaboy.
I know.
Attaboy.
I've just
Attaboy.
Had a hard life, Mr. Passman.
Attaboy.
I look old.
Mr. Representative Foggy, why don't we have you? We've got two more people to testify, and then we can bring you back. If you prefer to come.
Just to address that particular point.
We have two more people to testify. Why don't we just do that, and then we'll have you to wrap up. That's probably the cleanest way to do it. Ms. Marquardt. Mayor of Unalaska.
and been known to take people out on lovely boat rides and when the weather's nice.
That's right, and the weather's always nice.
Yeah.
We just don't want everybody moving there, so we say it's not. Thank you, Chairman French. Thank you, members of the body. For the record, my name is Shirley Marquardt. I am the mayor of the city of Unalaska, Port of Dutch Harbor, and I am also the current AML president. I had two quick points that I wanted to make today talking about this Bill 168. And the first would go back to the exemption for municipalities. And I think that's very important because there could be sometimes issues that come before government representatives that give them enough concern that they feel the only way that they can manufacture change or, you know, have an option is to go through the court system. And it's not something a municipality does lightly. There's a lot of cost involved and a lot of risk. And generally, you know, they don't have that kind of money lying around. And municipality, of course, operates all on public money, all on tax money. Everything that they bring in goes right back out in the big wheel in services and programs, et cetera. So, you know, in order for a municipality to try to take millions of dollars maybe and set it aside for, you know, as a bond if they need to speak onto an issue, if they've made that decision, that would be impossible for them to do. They simply could not remove that from their operating. So that's one. The second is in Alaska, we've lived under this scenario twice in the last 10 years. And it was about in 2000. I noticed in the definition here, fisheries aren't part of industrial organizations, which I think is a little interesting. But back in 2000, it was Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, and American Oceans filed a motion for an injunction in a federal court in Seattle, and a Judge Zille granted that motion and shut down pollock trawling in huge areas in the Bering Sea and in the Gulf of Alaska based on what he felt was NIMS had not taken into consideration ESA policy to the point where they were trying to do something in order to help the Steller sea lions. The problem was then and continues to be 12 years today, there's absolutely no science linking those fisheries with the demise of the Steller sea lion pups, which is it's a low pup count in the Western Aleutians. It's not starving sea lions. It never has been. So, you know, we're living under an injunction now. You've got Adak on Alaska, Accutan, Sandpoint, King Cove, Kodiak, and 63 villages in Western Alaska, CDQ villages that depend on these cod fisheries and pollock fisheries, which are now kicked out of the Western Aleutians while they take another 2 or 3 years and try to come up with some research money to figure out what is going on. Why is the pup count low? Because it doesn't seem to be an issue of food, of the food chain, which has been studied exhaustively in the last 12 years. So these occasions do exist, and I think it's very important, as Ms. Wasserman said, to allow a municipality as local representative government to be able to take that step if they need to without having to, you know, endanger operating funds. And that's all I have.
Questions from Ms. Marquardt? I don't see any. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Next up, last up, is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. I'm Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959. And I would like to go on record, actually, in support of House Bill 168. At least from our perspective, we did not look at this as changing any of the court rules out there in our own day-to-day world. And we don't have deep pockets either. And when we're looking at potential injunctions or any kind of issues dealing with employers or other issues that we may get engaged in on a day-to-day basis, we do look at them seriously. From our perspective, I guess, including the wages and benefits, and they talked about POGO, and that was actually one of the examples that I did use in a previous committee that this bill was heard. And I was aware that it was actually a federal issue, not a state issue. And I guess the fact that we had close to 60 people that were laid off in that particular project, using that, I guess, as an example on what would happen within the state on some of these projects. If this does nothing else but to encourage people to seriously take a look at it, we strongly support construction work, we strongly support it being done in a very environmentally safe way. We are concerned about the environment. We're concerned about the animals, and we represent people that work in these industries. And as such, we'd also be concerned about their health and safety on these particular jobs as well. I would add that, at least from our perspective, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to argue the additional legal issues out there, but honestly, what's wrong with asking people to put a little bit of skin into the process as some of these issues come up? If it does encourage people to be a little bit more proactive at the beginning of the environmental process, if I'm not mistaken, POGO, for example, was over 4 years in permitting. I mean, it's not something, these projects are not done lightly. And I think the issues and concerns from both sides definitely needs to be heard. And we don't believe that this bill would actually close that door. It would still allow people to come forward, groups or organizations, to voice their issues and concerns in court as they can today. But it does at least provide the wages and benefits if indeed there's a situation, and maybe there won't be in the future, that would actually negatively impact workers out there. So for those reasons, we support the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Huff-Peckness. I don't see any questions. Thank you. I'm going to ask the committee members to stay over for a few more minutes so we can let Representative Feige wrap up.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Representative Eric Feige from House District 12. To address the AML's concern regarding municipalities being exempt from suit or from exempt from having to post bonds, it's under Title 9, Section 09.68-040, subparagraph alpha. In an action or proceeding in a court in which the state or municipality is a party or in which the state or municipality is interested, a bond or undertaking is not required of the state, a municipality, or an officer of the state or municipality. So I believe existing state law already covers their concerns. Regarding the pictures of whatever happened in West Virginia, Mr. Chairman, the permitting process in Alaska is significantly different, I would expect, than the permitting process in West Virginia. And we take all the departments that issue permits, DEC, Fish and Game, DNR, take that responsibility very seriously. We have a very strong permitting system. It is our job in the legislature to oversee that, make sure that it stays strong, that it has the funds that it needs to do its job. There have not been any permits pulled back or rejected here within about the last 5 years. So I think that speaks quite solidly to the strength of our system. As far as Rule 65C, it already requires a bond. From testimony today, it appears judges are simply not requiring the bond, which is their prerogative, and House Bill 168 does not seek to instruct them. All it seeks to do is ask that they consider the wages of the affected employees and the wages of contractors to be considered in any bond that is posted. It does not give specific direction to the judges. It does not significantly change Rule 65C. Citizens still have the ability under current law, and will still have the ability under current law to bring suit. Nothing in House Bill 168 affects that. And finally, regarding the primacy issue, I can hand this to you, or I can and read it to you. It's some suggested language for a letter of intent to accompany the bill. As it's written here, it is the intent of the legislature that when deciding what security to require of a party seeking an injunction or stay of a permit affecting an industrial operation, the court consider the effect that the injunction or stay could have on the employees and contractors of the permittee. It is also the intent of the legislature not to constrain the court's authority or discretion under governing court rules, but to direct the court's attention to that category of potential harm to the permittee, its employees and contractors, that the requirement of security should protect against. It is the further intent of the legislature that this legislation, operating in conjunction with AS 96840C will assure the court's consideration of the potential impacts to permittees, employees, and contractors facing suspension of the permitted operations. And I'll leave that up for your consideration.
Please submit it to the. We'll take it and take a look at it. I guess anything else you want to add?
No, Mr. Chairman. Any further questions?
No further questions from me. I'll let you know that that's my biggest concern about the bill. There was a bill similar to this one that passed in Utah. Governor Huntsman vetoed it based on the primacy issue, and the Department of Natural Resources brought that up last year in the testimony before the House Judiciary Committee, concerned about the primacy issue. I'll note parenthetically that the court system also said they had concerns about, you know, how they would manage these bonds, and so I've checked a book about injunctions out of the courthouse library. I'm taking a look at that. It's a serious issue. I appreciate you bringing it to us. With that, we're going to set the bill aside, and unless there's something else to come before the committee, we'll adjourn.